Hello there. Welcome to Minnesota Opera's new podcast, Crescendo, Building the Future of the Arts. I'm Rick.
And I'm Jared, and we will be your hosts. In this podcast, we bring young, queer perspectives front and center.
As professional artists, educators, and administrators, we prioritize sustainable, holistic, and trauma-informed approaches to working in the performing arts.
Crescendo is a space to unpack histories and create exciting visions for the future of performance art industries. So settle in, because we're about to shake things up.
Here we are, Jared. It's finally happening. We are going to go through some introductions for ourselves in this episode. We're also going to discuss how we got to where we are now. And then later on, we'll touch base with a familiar voice to some of you, Rocky Jones, former host of The Score, and EDI director at Minnesota Opera, to check in on what he's been up to. But let's start with just getting to know us. Jared, what are you up to right now?
Yeah, so my name is Jared Miller. I use he, him pronouns. And I have a lot of jobs, but my three main big ones are as a music assistant paraeducator at North High School, where I play for the music department, the choirs, band, show choir, all that jazz. I am a core faculty member for the Ordway's Green Room Fellowship program, and I am one of three youth programs music directors at Minnesota Opera. And I am also a freelance pianist and coach for various local opera companies, orchestras, choirs, and arts organizations within the Twin Cities. Something that I try to bring to every art space that I participate in is a holistic approach to my art making, to try and create spaces that foster sustainability in the arts.
Jared, can you say a little bit more about the Green Room Fellowship at the Ordway? I know a little bit about it, but I'm not sure our audience would.
Yeah, thank you for asking. The Green Room Fellowship is this really amazing program that we have had two cycles of now that takes place over the summer. It is a BIPOC musical theater training fellowship program, and it is for BIPOC performers and put on by BIPOC faculty. And it's this summer intensive where a small group of fellows that go through a several step process, audition process, get to come in and work with various faculty members who have different backgrounds and specialties within the field and learn from us in classes that take place every other day. And there's like I think there's five faculty now, and I co-teach a class that is on telling your story, and we focus on how to create a sustainable career for yourself, vocal technique, how to select repertoire for yourself, what sort of rep you should be looking at, what should be in your audition binder, and lots of things like that. Holistic, very holistic, body-centered. We typically try to bring in an Alexander technician to come and help the singers and dancers and movers kind of figure out how to use their bodies properly within their art.
Yeah, thanks for telling us more about that. That sounds like a really interesting program. But I'll introduce myself a little bit as well. My name's Rick. I use they, them, and he, him pronouns. And I also have multiple jobs. A shocking event for professional musicians. My full-time job is that I'm the program manager at the Gender and Sexuality Center for Queer and Trans Life at the University of Minnesota. Longest title ever, but here we are. I'm also a master's student in the Arts and Cultural Leadership Program at the University of Minnesota. And in addition to what I do at the university, I'm also another one of the youth program's music directors at Minnesota Opera. Shout out to Sarah Sawyer, our teaching partner, who is not with us right now, but she's amazing in our classes. And I also teach privately for voice and piano in St. Paul. I mostly teach students. Usually I get between the ages of like 16 and 35, but I've taught as young as 4 and as old as 65. So I've had a broad experience with teaching. I also recently added a yoga teaching certificate to my background. So I've taught a yoga class or two, and I've been really enjoying it. I think it's like really connected to singing in ways that I didn't fully understand till I actually like got the yoga certificate. But now I incorporate a lot of yoga like practices into my voice lessons, obviously if the students are like open to it. But yeah, it's helped a lot of my students, I think. And I also perform occasionally, but I've, during my master's degree, I've like turned more towards administrative and teaching. And things that are important to me in all of my professional practices, I like to highlight queer and disability justice movements as much as I can. And I also use trauma-informed approaches. So like an example of that would be if I have a student who is experiencing some body-related dysphoria, I'm not going to have them look in the mirror during their voice lesson, right? Like I remember being asked to look in a mirror a lot during my voice lessons. And there were days where as a trans person, that was super uncomfortable for me. And I, as a teacher, don't want to kind of like perpetuate those things. It's not a bad practice. It's just not a good practice for everyone. So I like to be really sensitive to my students' preferences and needs in our time together. I know both of us have taken pretty unique paths to get where we are now. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey to where you are professionally?
Sure. Oh gosh. Okay. So it all started when I was a little tiny 4-year-old. My aunt was married to this classical pianist that she met when she was studying abroad in France. And they had both come to live with us for a while. And I would hear him practice piano all the time. I remember he would practice his scales and he was always working on Flight of the Bumblebee for some reason. I don't really know why. But I absolutely just fell in love listening to him. And as a little scrappy 4-year-old, I came to my parents and was like, I want to do that. I want piano lessons. And they were like, oh, you're a little young. Like, talk to us in a year and then we'll see if you still like it, because kids are fickle. And then I think like on my 5th birthday, I was like, okay, I'm older now. I'm wiser. I'm more mature. I want piano lessons. And they got piano lessons for me. And so I've been reading music for about as long as I could read like books. And it's just weird to think about now. But yeah, my journey was, I guess, pretty normal early on. I had a very strict, or she was very nice. Like, strict's not the right word to use, but like she was very kind of rigid in the way that she taught me. Like, she taught me that I needed to have the very straight, almost ballet-like posture at the piano, that over-the-top movements with my arms would be distracting. And she didn't really like me to deviate outside of the repertoire or exercises that she had assigned to me. And I learned a lot from her. I think that having those structures that she didn't want me to go outside of, they kind of activated my stubbornness. And I think that that's partly why I became such a good sight reader, because she wasn't letting me work on some things that I wanted to work on. So I just took it upon myself to learn them. And I would read through every single music book that we had at home. And I would, you know, my mom would take me to, shout out to Allen's Music Store. I don't know if they're still around in San Diego, but we would go there all the time. And I was like a kid in a candy shop, just buying sheet music of musicals and things that were beyond my skill level at that point. But I just had this like voracious appetite to read music, and I got really good at reading music because of it. In high school, I didn't really do much. I played for like my jazz band and things in middle school, but I didn't join choir until I was actually recruited into choir. I played a song from Songs for a New World for two of my friends on one of their choir concerts, and the teacher announced at that concert, and that was Jared Miller at the piano. He will be joining us next year in choir. And I was like, excuse me? And all my friends were like, we didn't know. And I was like, I didn't know either. And my parents were like, you didn't tell us. And so it was a big surprise to everybody. But she was a really great teacher, and she saw that I needed to be around music more than I was. And so she recruited me in, and I would often accompany the choirs. I served as a section leader my junior and senior years. I had several jobs in the community, playing for community theaters and things like that. Yeah, and I was very active from that point on. And then I had very much decided that piano was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a performer. And then my junior year, I cut off the tip of my pinky. And I will not go into the details. Rick has heard this story many times. I can share more about it on another episode maybe, but I was basically faced with a future where I might not even have use of my left hand. And it was not a fun thing to go through as a 16-year-old. Never thought I would have a literal existential crisis as a teenager, but I did. And that stubbornness kicked back in and I rehabilitated myself. I had to reteach myself to play with 9 fingers. I still auditioned for schools and I got into a couple, and I finally decided to go to St. Olaf College, which is where Rick and I met, where a decade-long journey began, basically. I auditioned for schools, like I said, I got in, and my journey has been one of just working my little tail off. And I did not have much of a social life in college. I was very much the student who like hung out with the faculty pianists to, you know, count up how many people we were playing for during jury season. And I played for so many recitals and student recitals. And I think I played for most of the choirs at that school at some point. And I played for lyric opera productions. Rick and I met during a lyric opera production of Der Vampir, right?
That is correct. That production, we'll get into it a little bit more later, but that production was wild. And it was a beautiful introduction to a now a good friend in you, Jared.
We had some good times there. Muffy, the vampire naysayer. It's on record now. But and then when I was at St. Olaf, I discovered that I'll talk about this more later, but I discovered that collaborative piano was a thing and that I could focus in what people know as accompanying. And that really resonated with me. And that's what I've focused on the last 8+ years now. And I went to the University of Minnesota right after college to get a degree in collaborative piano and vocal coaching. And I got a lot of wonderful training there and experience and connections. And I've accepted as many jobs as I could to get to where I am. And I've met a lot of really wonderful people. And I guess I'm just very grateful to get to do this, because I know that the pandemic especially was hard for the arts in general, but knowing so many people who were performers and are performers, I feel very fortunate to still be able to do it. So what about you, Rick?
Yeah, I totally resonated with something you said when you were like, I used to go to music stores and get music that was way too hard for me. Like I would go to Schmidt Music in Brooklyn Center, which sadly closed, but I would go there all the time because my sister was a flautist up through college. So I was just around music a lot. And I definitely remember getting like the $2 pieces of sheet music. Oh, when sheet music was $2. I miss those days. It's like $7 for a song now, 10 if you want to be able to print it. It's so wild. But I would grab so many things and I didn't even know how to read it yet. Like I took piano lessons as a kid. I didn't really click with my teacher though. So I decided to quit and I didn't really pick music back up until I was in middle school. But that I was like, we've got that foundation in common. But I was really privileged to go to 2 public schools with dedicated arts programs. At the time, Fred Moore Middle School Center for the Arts for middle school. And then for high school, I went to Buffalo High School, which at the time had an arts magnet program. I believe that's been dissolved, unfortunately. I thought it was a really great program in a more rural community. So it was really just a unique space. But in middle school, I started by playing the trumpet in band and I joined the jazz band. I actually had no really like interest in choir. I auditioned for musicals at my school, which that was kind of my outlet for singing at the time, which would later become kind of like the thing that I do. But I really dug into my instrumental journey as a sixth grader. And I went on and continued doing instrumental music in high school, though I switched to playing the tuba, which really should have been a sign that I was a lot queerer than I thought I was. I was even like captain of the sousaphone section in marching band because I'm very cool. But I really enjoyed the community of being in a band. I really enjoyed the conductors that I was able to work with. I feel like I learned a lot about how to be musical. And I feel just grateful to have an instrumental background as a singer, because I think it has given me a lot of strengths as a musician that I wouldn't have developed otherwise. But I began singing in high school more formally. I started taking classical lessons because I didn't get cast in the first musical that I auditioned for in my high school. So I decided, like, okay, I'm going to develop this skill. I took from Dan Henjum, shout out to Dan, and he exposed me to a lot of different styles of singing. I had wanted to focus really firmly on musical theater only, and he introduced me to classical music and opera. So without him, I might have like never become interested in that. But as I grew through high school, I came to realize that I had like a drive to sing, and I also was like pretty good at it. I discovered that I had this extended high range. It was like a young coloratura soprano. You could finally like see it in me. So I decided to pursue that in college. I studied vocal performance and theater. So I ended up getting 2 degrees at St. Olaf. It took me 5 years to complete to get those 2 degrees, but it was a challenging combination because those programs weren't designed to fit together, but I did my darndest and I annoyed a lot of professors and I made it happen for myself. But yeah, we met because we were both deeply involved in the lyric theater. I not only sang in those productions, but I also acted as stage manager a lot. I did most of the costume designs when I was there. I did production management and I was doing lead roles often at the same time. So it was a huge commitment for me every time that season rolled around, but it was just like such a beautiful time in my life. I have really fond memories. I also was a member of the St. Olaf Choir for 3 years in college. So I had the opportunity to travel the country, and we even went abroad to Japan and South Korea. So I've been very privileged to be able to travel as a performer. And I also traveled as a solo performer. I got to sing on stages across Italy and study German in Austria. So I've had a broad experience that I'm very privileged to have. I know it's not everyone gets the opportunity to study in those places, but it's definitely defined who I've become as a performer. And then, yeah, post-grad, I accepted a job as a music director for a youth theater company that I don't think exists anymore because COVID really did a number on our sector. But I remember just being so nervous when I got that job. I had been so focused on performing that directing was like this tower I didn't know how to like scale. But now that's mostly what I do. I find myself now really gravitating towards production management and directing. And that's been a really great place for me in the Twin Cities. So yeah, that's me, I guess. Now we can go into that stupid opera that we met doing. So it was called Der Vampir by Heinrich Marschner, originally in German, from like the 1800s, I want to say. But we had a director in our lyric theater, Jim McKeel. I love Jim McKeel. He's amazing. Just so fun to be around. But he selected an English version of the opera that was originally done by Boston Opera Hub, I believe. So it was in English and it was a spoof version. So it had references to Dracula, to Twilight, and to, what was the other one? Buffy. How could I forget? Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I was cast as Muffy, the vampire naysayer. How dare you out me like that, Jared? But
I had to. The name is too infamous for people to not know about it. And did they, I don't remember, did they end up keeping that name for you or did they change it?
They changed it, thank goodness, back to the original to like Emmy Perth was my name instead because, wow, I would not have been able to keep a straight face with Muffy the Vampire Naysayer. Like, I know I can't.
It was very, we were all giggling a lot when that was their first name on that stage. But yeah, how many other shows did we do together there? I know we did Die Fledermaus and I was not at Olaf when Redigor happened, but I did come in a couple times, I believe. And then didn't we also do Big Fish together?
Yeah, we did do Big Fish together. And did you also do a little bit of work on Cabaret, like as a coach? Right?
Yes, I came in I don't remember. I think it was, I helped with something on Cabaret. I know I came to some rehearsals for that, but I didn't play for the show.
Yeah, no, we worked on several productions together and we definitely, at times ran in similar social circles, but I feel like we had a young working relationship where we just had a lot of fun. We were both very goofy, and I think we both picked up on that. So I always felt super comfortable when, like, you were in the room. I knew it was going to be a good time when Jared Miller was on the scene.
Well, thank you. I felt the same way. And it's been really cool to get to continue to work with each other outside of college, because, you know, you get to meet so many people from so many different places when you're in an institution like that. And then you graduate and sometimes you don't see any of them again. And I think the Twin Cities is a really great place to continue a lot of those relationships. And yeah, I'll let Rick talk a little bit about some of the other projects we've done together.
Yeah, I was really glad. I did some auditioning around the Twin Cities right after I graduated in 2019. And I think you were a pianist in an audition that I did. And I was like, oh, Jared, thank goodness. I feel so comfortable. And I did end up getting cast as a like regularly occurring singer for a series that a company was doing. And you were often the collaborative pianist on those projects. So we got the opportunity to do a lot of really fun, just like individual pieces, though sometimes they'd ask me to do like three or four. So sometimes we were working together a lot. But then lockdown, boom, boom, boom. It happened to all of us, and it was no fun for any of us, I don't think. So we had a kind of a hiatus, and I think we kind of fell out of contact during that time. But then in 2022, the summer of 2022, super randomly, we find out that we both got hired to be youth programs music directors at Minnesota Opera. Like, we did not know that the other had applied or had been in conversation. It was just like your name popped up in an email and I was like, yes, I'm so excited that Jared's going to be my coworker. And yeah, since then, I feel like we've been regular coworkers and just like friends. And we also have a project coming up on April 4th, 2024 at the U of M, produced through the Gender and Sexuality Center. It's called Queer Life, a Trans Narrative Recital. And I'm managing the production, and I'm also doing lead vocals, and Jared's our pianist and also lead collaborator. He's taking on some additional administrative roles and being just a helpful, good friend. But it's going to be amazing. I think we've had a couple band rehearsals now, and it just sounds so good with more than the two of us. I just am so excited. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that project in upcoming episodes. So stay tuned. It'll be a good night, I think.
Now let's talk about some of the, a little bit more in depth about some of the paths that we've taken. I know that there are some traditional paths that people think of when they think of pianists and singers, and we'll take a second now to just talk about how we have or haven't fit into those. For me, like I mentioned a little bit earlier, until I got into college, I didn't realize that a career as a collaborative pianist was a thing. I thought that if you wanted to do piano performance, you did solo piano, like playing concertos and piano, solo piano recitals, memorizing everything, stuff like that, and that pianists in general just accompanied in some capacity. It wasn't until like towards the end of my freshman year when I had a check-in with my teacher, and I was just like, I'm kind of miserable. Like, I don't like the solo rep that I'm doing. I love playing with all of my new friends. I love accompanying them. And she was like, well, why don't you do collaborative? And I was like, what the heck is collaborative? And shout out to Catherine Ananda Owens. She was one of the best teachers that I've ever had. And she taught me what collaborative piano is, which is, I always describe it as non-solo playing, basically. So any sort of accompanying or playing that you do where you have a partner or multiple partners on stage. And oftentimes what goes hand in hand with collaborative piano playing is coaching, which includes getting to dig into poetry and language coaching. I took diction classes at St. Olaf and in grad school, and I got a lot of the similar training that singers have to go through, because there's a big overlap. And yeah, collaborative piano was the right choice for me. And like I said, she was a great support for me during my undergrad. And she knew that I had a pretty good read on how much I could take on. And so she said yes to a lot of the projects that I wanted to do. She knew that I was playing for the Lyric Opera shows and that I oftentimes had anywhere between like 5 and 10 recitals a semester, on top of sometimes playing for 25 or 30 juries at the end of the semester every year. But I learned a lot with her, and she was the best like option that I think I could have gotten as a teacher going into that school, because I got in playing with Nine Fingers. And I remember on my first lesson with her, she sat me down and I kind of reiterated to her that I might be a little bit different than other pianists that she's taught in the past, because at that time I physically could not use my pinky on my left hand. And she brought out her gigantic Gray's Anatomy book and opened it up to the diagrams of the hands. And I'm sorry, A-OK, I don't remember what tendons and muscles you said I was straining, but she pointed out which ones I was putting extra tension on with the alignment that I had basically taught myself when I re-taught myself how to play. So she's a performance health expert, and she worked so much with me on body awareness. We did some Alexander technique stuff. She helped me really just get in tune with my body and be able to read signs of when I was overplaying, or maybe I wasn't following through enough with my hand, or my technique was off in some way, and basically just helping me not push through moments of discomfort. Because more often than not, and I saw this all the time when I was at Olaf, pianists, we practice a lot. And people who focus on solo piano, I know from those that I know, like, spend hours and hours and hours and hours in the practice room, and a lot of them got tendonitis. And despite my finger injury, I have never once gotten tendonitis, knock on wood. And I really attribute that to A-OK. Like, she helped me so much be able to figure out when I needed to stop or when I needed to play lighter. Because especially in that fall break tech week time for Lyric Opera Theater, Rick knows, we would be running the show, what, sometimes 2-3 times a day. And I was the only pianist for it, and I would have to be there for everything. And there would be, you know, 8 to 10 hour days of me sitting at a piano playing an opera reduction. So thank you, A-OK, for all of that help. And to answer my question about traditional paths, yes and no, I would say I fit into that, in that I wanted to begin in the traditional path, and I kind of went in another direction. And then even in that direction, I've learned a lot. Like when I went to grad school, just because of life transitions and everything like that, I entered into a pretty long, I mean, it was like a year and some change long depression. And I obviously wish I hadn't gone through that, but I learned a lot through it. And when I was at the U of M doing my grad studies, I was leaving basically every performance, every lesson that I played, every practice session, just feeling really dissatisfied with the work and the music that I was making, which was, you know, is that vicious cycle. I just kept feeling down, and then I felt sad that I was feeling down, and then blah, blah, blah. And I finally, like, I reached a point where I kind of sat with myself, and I asked myself, what has been the point of these hours and hours and hours and years of study for me to not be happy with the music that I make? What's the deal with that? And I did a lot of deep thinking. It was I think I spent a lot of time with my thoughts over that summer, and it was really beneficial for me. It kind of started me on this path that I'm on now about holism and sustainability. And the path that I was on, the way that I was working myself to the bone, was not healthy physically or mentally for me at the time. And kind of thinking about all of this and remembering why I fell in love with music in the first place helped kind of recenter me and figure out, like, okay, I just played for this recital. I didn't get to practice every song as many hours as I maybe would have been able to in my undergrad. Does that mean that I'm bad? No. The answer to that is almost always no. And I worked very intentionally to be able to get to a point where I can leave a performance, know that I made some, you know, some in spur of the moment improvisations, as I'd like to call them, and know that it's still, I still did a pretty good job out there, and that most people in the audience don't care about that one note out of the thousands that I probably played. They don't care that that one's incorrect. And yeah, it's just, it's become such a big part of my own philosophies as a performer and as a teacher and educator, a coach, that I think it's so easy when we, for those of us who have gone through academic music and who now are in a place where our passion is also our career, it's really easy for those lines to get blurred and get into a point of being overly critical of yourself. And that is what leads to burnout. And I have been there myself. I'm sure you have too, Rick. And another, like, I guess, non-traditional path that I've taken is that I have really used music as a way to connect more with my own identity as a performer and as a Latine individual. My first teacher very much was like, you need to learn the Mozart, the Beethoven, the Schubert, all the Bach, all those pieces. And I could play them, and I never really liked playing them. And my mom said that I sounded like a robot, and AOK, I think, once said that my playing was anemic, and
oof.
But they were right. And it wasn't really until I was given a stack of music by a friend, and I discovered the Goyescas piano suite by Enrique Granados. And he's a Spanish composer. And I listened to these pieces. I found Alicia de la Rocha's recordings of them. She's my all-time favorite pianist. And I was like, there's something here that speaks to me in a different way. And as a teenager, I did not really understand what it was. And then in college, I sought out more Spanish music, specifically Mexican music. And it just always, it spoke to me in a different way. I was able to connect to it. And it at times even felt easier for me to play. And I have tried and continue to try as much as I can to promote Spanish music, play Spanish music when I can. And it's been a way for me to connect with my own Latinidad and express myself in ways that are not always built to do in music schools.
Yeah, I think, thanks for sharing about that. I think your journey through music is like so interesting. And for me, being on the, I guess, quote unquote, singer track, I think the main option that was communicated to me in high school was, oh, you have to go to college for singing. So that's what I did. I don't think that's the only option. I know a lot of people who did not go to college and they just started professional working careers and now they're greatly successful. So that was just the path that was opened up to me based on the teachers around me. And I mean, I'm glad I went where I did. That's how we met. That's how I ended up where I am. But I definitely think there were other options that just weren't given to me. So I went to college. As I was an undergrad, I was paired with Dr. Tracy Engelman, which for those of you who are Minnesota Opera audience members, you may remember her as Papagena in The Magic Flute, the really cool projected production. It was super cool. I was in her studio as she was doing that role, and I remember hearing all about it. And that was one of my first introductions to Minnesota Opera, was hearing about her talk about that experience. But I'm really grateful that I ended up with her because she has a vocal pedagogy degree. She's really aware of like vocal health, which I've also had teachers and coaches who do not know a lot about vocal health and therefore give really maybe not bad advice, but it's inefficient. The singing is inefficient and therefore you have less stamina, right? And Dr. Engelman is just a professional. Like, she really understands, and she and I had very similar voice types at the time. We probably still do. But I remember inquiring, like, what are my options to go through a career in singing, specifically in singing opera? And the track that was told to me by pretty much every coach or teacher I came in contact with was, well, you go to undergrad for vocal performance, and then you get a master's of music in vocal performance so that you can get accepted to young artist programs so that you can become a resident artist and then have this illustrious career around the globe. And I know one singer who has like actually taken that track. Alma Newhouse, she's a boss. She's amazing. Beautiful mezzo. You should definitely check out what she's up to over in Europe at the moment. But that track isn't accessible for everyone, right? It's kind of a crapshoot. You don't really know if you're going to make it, quote unquote. And also, like, as a neurodivergent person and a trans person, that track becomes even less healthy for me to navigate. Like, I remember having coaches talk to me all the time about how I looked bored when I was in lessons, not when I was performing. Like, I'm super emotive. I think I really bring great acting chops to the table as a singer. Hopefully, Jared, you can confirm. But in lessons or in sessions, I was so focused. And I guess it just looked like I did not want to be there, didn't care. And I didn't feel like people understood. I actually am just really focused and intrigued and engaged. Like, I'm not trying to make you upset, but I definitely think I didn't get some opportunities because of being neurodivergent. And then also being a trans person, I actually felt like I couldn't explore my gender identity because there's just this hyper feminine look that coloratura sopranos especially are supposed to adhere to. So I did. I mean, I identified as non-binary since the age of 19, but I had this really femme expression because I felt like that's what I needed to do in order to be successful. I remember even seeing one of my peers get docked points in a competition because she chose to wear pants. Like, a cis woman wearing pants made her like get docked points. Me as a trans person, what does that mean for me, right? So I feel like I kind of shied away from exploring that identity until I actually had a break during the lockdown. Like, during COVID, I really got in touch with what I needed. And I took probably a year off singing, period. Like, I really didn't sing at all for the first year of lockdown. I never practiced. I was teaching lessons, but that's pretty much all I did because I just needed to do like a hard reset and kind of understand what I wanted as a trans person and a singer. Like, you know, am I going to take hormones and change this voice, this instrument that I've trained to a T for like over 10 years, right? So it's just a different experience, I think. And that was never communicated to me. So I felt like I was doing something wrong by not going down that one path. But now I look at where I am and I'm really happy about where I am. I'm going to finish my master's degree in a more administrative side of things, which is going to allow me to have something not only to, you know, engage in really mindfully, but also to fall back on when another global health pandemic occurs, right? Like, we know another one's coming at some point. And now I feel like I have this expertise in another area that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But that's kind of my path. I think I'm still on it. I'm hoping to get back into performing more. This recital that we're doing together is an opportunity for me to really infuse queerness and transness into my performing arts practice. So I'm excited to actually have that opportunity now for the first time. And really, like, that queer identity is front and center. It's not separated from my art. It like is the art that I'm doing. So that's been really great.
And I feel like that's so important to do as a performer. Like, for the longest time, I didn't think to include that I was queer or Mexican in any of my promotional material because I was like, well, I don't want people to tokenize me or something like that. But it was certainly limiting for me too in different ways. Like, it was something that I was trying to connect with more, but then I was not connecting it to such a huge portion of my life. And even in like performance attire, like, I think I have many different pressures than you do. But as a pianist, I've always been told you need to wear black. You need to, if you're male presenting, mask presenting, you need to wear a suit. It needs to be black. You need to blend in with a piano. And I didn't like that. And you know, you've seen how I dress now. I dress colorfully. I have pops of color I have my fancy shoes that people kind of know me for. I have some pretty cool earrings now, I think. And it started in college with the shoes, I think, when I started wearing more colorful, more bombastic, like, patterns and things. I don't know if that's the right word, but because I was like, if I'm the pianist for a recital, this recital can't happen without me. I mean, it could happen with another pianist, but it can't happen without a pianist. And so I don't want to hide in the background. I don't want to blend in with the piano. I'm not a piece of furniture. And I've really extended that more in my performing now. Like, I don't think I've worn a suit to perform in maybe 3-4 years now. I've started buying more and wearing more like traditional Mexican clothing. I have a couple guayaberas that I wear, which are these Mexican shirts that usually have really beautiful embroidery on them. And those are what I wear to perform now, because my Mexican heritage is important to me. It's something that I'm still discovering. I'm still learning about my family, about the food, about the language, everything. And clothing is a way that I can express that. And I think for everybody of any sort of identity, queer folk especially, like, we like to express ourselves with clothing. And I think I'm seeing it change slowly in the opera world, that like blind casting is happening more. Not everywhere, but I certainly believe that you shouldn't be judged for clothing. You shouldn't be judged for those sorts of things. Like, you're going to be wearing a costume if you're on stage. It shouldn't matter what you show up to for an audition. I got off on a tangent there, but...
No, but I mean, I think it's important to shout out your fashion choices, because they are stunning. And it's also important, I think, to talk about just like the expectations that have kind of been baked into the opera industry. And a lot of times, I think, I even find myself perpetuating things that I haven't unpacked yet. And I have to kind of take a step back and go, wait a second. I know I was told that, but like, does that have any merit? Like, it was just a tradition. Just because it's been done for a long time doesn't mean it has to be done forever. Like, you know, it's important to take into consideration like histories, but it's also important to know that life changes, the world changes, and we're allowed to make things a little more fun. Like, let's go. In our guest for this episode, Rocky Jones, the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Director at Minnesota Opera. You may recognize his beautiful voice as one of the hosts of The Score, Minnesota Opera's previous podcast. A great person to work with, a really great resource to have on staff, and we're excited to bring him in. So welcome, Rocky Jones.
Oh my goodness. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited that this is happening.
Yes, thank you for making it so that we could be here.
Oh, well, I don't know about all that, but I'm happy that you're here, and I'm so happy that I can help out in whatever way that I can.
Yeah, we're super glad to have you joining us. And how's it going? What's been up? I know we're just post season. We're getting back into the daily grind, which I am kicking and screaming. I do not want to go back, but here we are. How are you doing as we come back to the regular?
You know, I took basically the last 2 weeks of 2023 off, because I'm sure we'll get into it, but I have been just so busy lately, just burning the candle at both ends, like pulled in 10 different directions. And so I just needed some time to just be still and just like do nothing. And now we are back in the rat race, and 2024 is just kicking my ass this week. It's kind of amazing. I lost my phone in a lift last night.
No.
I know. Thankfully I got it back, but like, I just, yeah, my brain is just
mush.
Yes. And I'm a Sagittarius with ADHD anyway, so So it's hard out here.
From one brain of mush to another, I resonate with all of that. This has been like, the break has been really nice. And the closer I got to like my school job starting, I love my students. But I was just like, oh, geez, I'm not ready to be around so much energy again. And I'm very tired. I'm very tired right now. I've only been back to work for less than a week. And I'm like, oh, goodness.
I was just going to agree. It's exhausting. All this energy.
Yes. And we had our first night back at our youth opera programs for Minnesota Opera last night. And the energy of over a dozen middle schooler and high schoolers, hopefully some of them are listening. We love you. Great to have you every week. And we are older and tired and have brains made of mush. So it's definitely like an adjustment for those energy levels coming back.
Well, you all just wait a couple of decades and add some old bones to that. It's super fun. It's super fun.
So what sort of things are you working on right now? Can you tell us about any of them?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, first of all, this show, super excited that this is now part of the EDI portfolio at Minnesota Opera. And of course, we're always myself and the rest of the Impact team, Darius and Emil and Faye and both of y'all and Sarah are always working on auditing the policies and practices and systems in place at Minnesota Opera to make sure that we are creating art in a way that is as inclusive and as equitable and just accessible as possible for everyone that walks through those doors. Which of course is a full-time job, so thank God they pay me a full-time salary.
We do love a full-time salary.
We do love a full-time salary, I'm just saying. It's been an adventure, certainly. I've been doing EDI work at Minnesota Opera for the last, July it'll be 4 years. I think right now we are sort of at a time just sort of in the world where, there are forces out there, political forces that are definitely using now EDI, it seems like, is the new cudgel or DEI or whatever you want to call it. That can be a little demoralizing, when you get on social media, you're looking at the news and sort of seeing that. But I do feel very lucky that I work for an organization that is still really out there on the forefront. I got a really sweet note from a former employee who left, I guess it was last fall, and moved back to the East Coast for another opportunity. But she wrote me a note over the holidays saying like it was just kind of jarring no longer working for a company that puts their values out there front and center and is always trying to do work that's in alignment with those values, and especially anti-racist values and anti-oppressive values, and just how much she appreciates the work that we have been doing, because now she's going to take it with her and fight the good fight over where she's working. So that's been really exciting and cool. And so always just doing that. And, we do workshops for the staff and access and civic engagement work out in the community, and y'all's work with the kids, which is pretty amazing and spectacular. So all of that's going on trying to support our productions as best as I can. And then outside of that, actually, it's very, you all mentioned The Score, which is the show that I used to host with our former vice president of Impact, Lee Bynum, and our former civic engagement manager, Paige Reynolds. And we've actually been picked up by Lincoln Center to Untappd to host a new show called Art Class. Yay. And so that's super exciting. And so we have, you know, and it's basically kind of going to be the score on steroids. So, you know, if you are a longtime supporter of Minnesota Opera, you may have heard an episode or two of the score, and it's going to be kind of like that, but on steroids. I think, you know, if you did listen to the score, you kind of saw sort of the evolution. You know, we were talking about, you know, opera and classical music through the lens of anti-racism and anti-oppression. But towards the end of the show, this past spring and summer, we were kind of branching out into other topics. And so, you know, I think this new show, we get to sort of really sort of examine sort of the width and breadth of our interests. So, you know, and Lincoln Center just has its, they have their fingers in so many different genres. So, you know, being able to, you know, talk about opera and classical music, of course, still, but, you know, theater and dance and visual arts and architecture and film. And did I say film? I don't even know. But so many things. The list is long. The list is long. So, you know, very, very excited to dive into that. And so that will premiere on Tuesday, January 16th. Oh, and
coming up.
Oh, believe me, I know. we have a discussion about book banning with the amazing author Janata Petrus, and all sorts of new cool segments, and a new cast of characters that join us for those segments. And so I think it's going to be a really fun time. And so, yeah, check it out wherever fine podcasts are aggregated.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be a listener. I was, as you know, we've talked about it, I was a big fan of the score, also a guest one time. Thanks
and
for
you
having
were
me.
An amazing guest. I still love your episode so much.
But yeah, the book banning, I can't wait to listen to that. I think that's such an important topic to the queer community and communities of color. Like, that's, it's such, there's just like a, it feels like it's like a constant attack on anything that doesn't align with that kind of cis heteronormative white supremacist agenda, if we're being honest.
Absolutely.
So I'm really excited to hear what your guest has to say and the reflections that you all come up with on that episode.
Yeah. It was definitely a really, really interesting conversation, because like you said, it really seems to be about sort of, you know, for those of us who are queer, especially for those of us who are queer folks of color, it's just sort of like this desire to just erase our existence. And I don't know, like, you can't do that. It's the long and short of it, you know, and the fact that people are fighting back against it so hard is so gratifying. But the fact that like this is gaining traction at all is just so dispiriting. Just the fact that, like, you know, you can tell when you, especially like with Janata and her book that showed up in a number of banned book lists in Texas and Florida and all over the place, you know, for just telling a story about two black young teenage girls who fall in love with each other. It's so clear that they didn't even read the books. Because if you've read the book, the overwhelming thing that you come away with is that this is a story about love. It's about love. And to this desire to just sort of shove us in the closet. And, you know, I mean, it, obviously it's all just financially motivated and politically motivated. And, but it's just, it's so frustrating. And so I think we talk a lot about that frustration, but also at the same time, like, you know, she was on a banned book list with like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin and some various and other sundry like bad bitches. So, you know, you know,
it's not bad company.
I'm just saying. Yeah. So, you know, there are some silver linings, I guess, in a weird way, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm also super excited to listen to this it's a constant battle that unfortunately our communities are having to face. And the more we talk about it and the more we keep it in the forefront, the more impact we can have on it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's so obvious and it's so cynical that it's just incredible that like we're still doing this in 2024. It's just, but I guess I shouldn't be too terribly surprised. This is
always something.
I'm just saying.
So how do you see Minnesota Opera engaging in EDI work?
Well, you know, I'll give you a little bit of context. You know, the work that we've been doing, you know, we've really been doing it in earnest since 2016, that fateful year. And I think it's really, really grown and evolved. I think at first it was just sort of this idea that like, you know, okay, we need to get, you know, more people of color in the audience. So like, you know, let's just invite more people of color and, you know, sort of see what happens. And I think it has grown and deepened so much over the course of the last few years to something that feels very... we ended up working with a consulting group called Team Dynamics, and once we started working with them, they're a women-owned, BIPOC-owned, LGBTQ+-owned firm here in the Twin Cities, and and so what they really came in and they really just, you know, got everyone on staff together, really sort of pointed out like a lot of the ways that like the systems and the procedures and policies in place are, you know, sort of aligning with white supremacy. It's not a secret that, you know, the Opera House has been a space of exclusion for literally centuries. You know, really getting folks to see like, what are some of the policies that we have in place? What are some of sort of the customs and practices, like even of just going into a hall and watching opera, that like, you know, are very exclusionary, that like keep young people out, that keep queer people out, that keep people of color out. You know, what are some of the, you know, stereotypes of opera that we have sort of leaned into? And what are some of the ways that we can heal from that we can actually heal ourselves? And so I think if you, you know, look at our diversity charter, you know, we really sort of make the case in a number of different ways. But, you know, there's a financial case for doing this work. There's an artistic case for doing this work. There's an obvious moral imperative to doing this work. But I think it really was about just sort of changing the way as an organization, we just sort of see ourselves and our role in the community as artists. And I think there was a survey that came out a couple of months or that came out that we did of the staff a few months ago. And I think it's like 85% of people on staff at Minnesota Opera consider themselves an artist. And I think as artists, it's our duty, it's our job to hold a mirror up to our society, to create spaces that promote justice and refuge and healing and hope. You know, that, you know, obviously, you know, we don't turn a blind eye to, you know, the injustices and the suffering that's happening in the world, but also we do our best to create beauty and bring joy into the world. And in that way, I see us as more, more than an arts institution, especially if we're taking public money, I see us as a civic institution. And as a civic institution, we have a duty to really create an organization that is creating a product that really reflects the community that we live in, the entire community that we live in. And so I think over the years, finally, I promise I'll answer your question, Jared. and so I think, you know, it's just the shift in sort of the thinking, the way that like we have decided that like actually we can create opera in a new way. We can bring new folks in. So I think things like, you know, this New Works initiative that we're doing that is bringing in young composers and librettists of color and, you know, over the course of, you know, 7 years, giving them the chance to create chamber pieces and operettas and then full scale opera pieces that'll be performed at the Ordway is super exciting. I think just the fact that we have an impact team and that people are coming and utilizing us and thinking about, you know, I think about like, you know, all of our departments are doing really, really great work. But, you know, I'm thinking about like, you know, the production department and like thinking about, you know, the way that they are approaching, you know, sort of work-life balance, because that production work can, you know, 24/7 if you let it. And there are so many, you know, places where the production departments are, you know, being, you know, just overworked. And, you know, thinking about like intimacy direction and we are the only opera company, or at least we were a couple of years ago, that, you know, utilizes an intimacy director in all of our productions. And so I just am really, really proud of, you know, what we've been able to do. I think between 2019 and I think 2022, I might have those dates wrong. But we went from 3% folks of color on the staff to 33% or 30% folks of color on the staff. And then in positions of leadership, it went from 0% to 23%. And so I just sort of see Minnesota Opera sort of leaning in and becoming a place where people want to come and work, people want to come and sing. And, you know, especially, you know, with the productions that we've been doing lately, like Crusar and Song Poet, a company that's really listening to its community and really interested and excited about telling the community's stories. I don't know. I think that's cool. Does that answer your question? I'm so sorry. Just going on and on and on.
Yeah. So. yeah, that all sounds like it's great stuff. And those are pretty big leaps and percentages of diversifying the employees and upper leadership. So that's really amazing to hear. And yeah, I know that when I saw Crusar, I was weeping like a baby. Like,
yeah.
Anytime I get to see that type of music and that representation on a stage like the Ordway, it's just like, it's really transformative for me. And I can only imagine how impactful it is for other people.
Yeah. And it was a really special piece.
Yeah. Thanks for, I feel like I learned things that I didn't know, you know, Jared been on staff for like a year and a half in the impact team. And it's just nice to hear what's been going on over a longer period of time. But thank you so much for joining us, Rocky. Is there anything else you want to shout out to the audience before we sign off?
No, just that I'm super excited that Crescendo is here and it's happening. And I'm super excited to be a part of it. And congratulations, y'all are killing it. Can't wait to hear what you all do next.
Thanks, Rocky.
I'm excited. We have lots of ideas.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. All right. Well, thanks, y'all.
Yeah, thank you, Rocky.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in to our inaugural episode of Crescendo, Building the Future of the Arts. We hope you'll join us again for future episodes.
You can look forward to another release from us in a couple weeks when we will be discussing how to define success as an artist. Don't forget to keep up with Minnesota Opera, including updates on our podcast on Instagram. And until next time, take care.